Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Going to take a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back, and thank you so much for listening in. Questions, give us a call. Our lines are already all filled at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can also post a question on or a comment on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Sandy, good to have you back.
Nice to be back.
We already have a Facebook question for you.
All right.
And I think it's an interesting one, so let's go to it. Mary Beth says, my vets have recommended Science and Ekaniba.
Ekaniba
for my dog. I recently went to a store, though, where the owner put her nose way in the air and said, I don't sell garbage. So do dogs eat best on vegetarian diets, all meat diets, or something in between? What does the research show?
Okay, I'm going to have to say something in between. Dogs are not strict carnivores like cats are. They're omnivorous, which means that they are able to, like us, digest and utilize vegetable material and so on. So having an all-meat diet would be unbalanced and inappropriate for a dog. So that's why you have to be really careful if you're going to be coming up with your own homemade diet. But what's interesting, I'm glad we got this, is because I actually came up with a quiz for you, Larry, regarding some of the things that are on the labels of pet food. So, you know, when you go into some of these higher-end pet food stores and you're looking at, I mean, it's overwhelming, all the different foods that are out there. But, you know, people will be reading the label and they'll see animal byproducts. True or false? Does that mean that it's lower quality if they contain animal byproducts?
Probably would depend on the, I wouldn't say necessarily.
Yeah.
No.
I think when people think of animal byproducts, they think, it's got to have like hair and hooves and intestinal contents and so on. It is leftover stuff from the slaughter floor for human consumption. So, it's non-rendered. This is the definition, non-rendered clean parts other than meat derived from slaughtered animals. So it's going to be lungs and spleen and kidneys and liver and so on.
All right.
So you can buy dog food that says, you know, contains liver, okay? Well, that's a byproduct, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's not that, you know, you have to be really careful when you're looking at the bags and interpret some of this stuff. What about organic? Is there anybody regulating the organic label like that is on human food?
I have never read anything about
people
organic.
Think, oh, I've got to have organic for my dog since I want it for myself. Well, guess what, folks? No regulations, okay? So nothing. So there's nobody that's going to be checking to make sure that the ingredients that they're putting in are truly organic. So they can put that on the bag, but you may not get that when you actually buy it.
Oh, good. I got two right.
Yeah. What about human grade? Okay. When they say human grade, what does that mean? Is there any, you know, anything out there that says that, you know, there's a regulation that if you're using stuff that says human grade?
No.
No. Okay.
It just probably means that I could eat it and probably not die.
Well, that's true for probably any dog food that's out there, but I'd probably just die from laughter watching you. But yeah, no, human grade, nothing specified in the regulations. And so, and that's surprising to some people. But when you look at even animal byproducts, that's liver, and some people eat kidneys, and in some, you know, countries, tripe, which is considered a byproduct, which is the cleaned out intestinal tract and so on. That's a delicacy for some types of
haggis.
Yes, and all, you know, it depends on what country you're from. So, no, human grade doesn't mean anything. And what about premium? Oh, we only carry premium pet foods at our store.
I know that's not true.
Yeah, it isn't. Okay, premium's nothing. Okay, it's a label they can put on, and it could be garbage. Okay, and yet they can still put premium on their label, and it makes the consumer think that they're getting something better. Same for holistic. Okay, we see a lot of these things, holistic diets. I mean, like, what does that mean? Like, that's just, again, a name. So don't get suckered into this. The only one that has any meaning is regulated is natural. When you have the bag that says natural, that means that it has to contain only things that are like nothing that's man-made, nothing synthesized, okay, no chemicals, except for vitamins and minerals. And so even the preservatives and so on, which all pet food has to have to be natural preservatives like vitamin E. So there you go.
Yeah, and so I think I got an A.
You did. So, and you know what? My vet students, I gave them this quiz before I came here and they flunked. And so, yeah, they did. And so you can imagine that somebody...
Well, they were overthinking it, probably.
They were overthinking it. But back to this person's question, both those diets, there's a lot of research done into them. They're well-balanced foods. Dogs do very well on them. That's why we've got pets living as long as they are right now, because we have such wonderful diets and veterinary care and so on for them. So if your dog is doing well on the foods that you're feeding, then by all means, stay with it. And I'm not going to fix what isn't broken.
And Judith just pointed out that premium does mean something. It means expensive.
Yes. Okay. There you go. Yep. You put that on there. It means expensive. Okay.
Oh, boy. Armando in Galena, Illinois, let's go to you. Hi, Armando.
Hey, good morning, Larry, and good morning, Doctor. Thank you very much for your time. I have a problem. I had 3 Airedales, and they were getting old, and I got a little girl about 2 years ago. And in the meantime, I had 1 Airedale that died of old age at age 16 about a year and a half ago. And then another one had bone cancer in his rear leg in September of last year. And the last one that I had died about 2 weeks ago. Anyhow, Willow, the little girl, now she's going to be almost 3 years old. She changed completely. Now she doesn't go. We live in a little farm, and she doesn't like to go out. She just stays sleeping all day.
Mm.
And she never slept in my room. Now she comes and sleeps in my room under the bed. And then when I'm going to give her the food, she doesn't eat, even if it is, you know, I make chicken soup with a big piece of chicken and potatoes and all of that.
Oh.
I have to give it by hand, and she takes it in her mouth, but with not too much of appetite, but she eats it. But otherwise, she doesn't eat it.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. First of all, the fact that she's not eating, I would be thinking it would be a good idea to take her in to make sure that there isn't anything physically wrong with her. If she checks out fine physically, you know, then we'd chalk it up to, is she grieving? Is she going through, you know, kind of, if she only knows life with having other dogs there that, you know, would be the first one to go out the door and maybe the first one to run in the kitchen and eat or, you know, do anything. Sometimes some dogs are just followers and they don't know what to do when they are all by themselves. A couple of things that you may want to try. If she is dog friendly, talk to some friends that have another, you know, dog friendly dog and just say, can we just borrow your dog, you know, have it at our house for a week or two and just see if that perks her up. If it is, if, you know, she does get better, then that may be part of it. You may find that if she, again, is dog friendly, going to something like doggy daycare where she can spend the day playing with other dogs and interacting, that may help her as well. And be really careful that you're not, your grief of losing all those wonderful older Airedales, you know, isn't, you know, being transferred to her. Thank you, Larry. Yeah, because sometimes when we're depressed and our schedule changes because we're no longer having to, you know, go outside with the older dogs and help them or whatever, you know, that can be a problem for the younger dog that's left behind too, because our behavior has changed. So try to stay with the same schedule you've always had, and hopefully that will help her. Good luck. This
Good
is
luck.
A sad one.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. So I get, and sometimes animals can grieve. On the other hand, I remember Patricia McConnell saying when her dog, one of her dogs died, she was saying on the air, she thought the other dog would really grieve, one of the other ones, and he seemed happy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of them, especially if, you know, there's been a little bit of kind of conflict between them or whatever, they're much happier. So that's why you don't go out and get another dog for your dog, because that's why I'm like, borrow one before you go out, because it may not be that she wants another dog. She wants those dogs that are already gone.
Christine in Woodstock, Illinois. Let's turn to you now. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I took in a stray cat. He's a great, very, very friendly cat, but he has an insatiable hunger. We try to feed him by the guidelines to his weight on the bag, but he just wants more and more and more and just seems to kind of eat everything he can anywhere he can get it. He's getting very fat.
Yeah, and that it can be a real problem because, you know, diabetes and orthopedic diseases and they can't groom themselves and so on. And so, you know, it's good of you to try to maintain a normal weight. We don't want him to get fat. So, you know, I call this the living through the depression stage, okay, for a cat that comes in as a stray. If he was on the street and was missing meals, he may think that, you know, this, if I don't eat now, I may not have another meal again. So a few things that you may want to consider doing. One would be to slow his eating down. Instead of just putting it in the dish and, you know, letting him just chow down, make it a little more difficult for him to get his food, to slow his mealtime down. He may get more enjoyment from it. Things that you can do would be to use a muffin tin to spread the food out in little containers in a muffin tin. You could use something like a treat ball. They sell them at pet stores. You can load it with about a quarter cup of their food, and as it rolls around, it dispenses little bits of food, and he can, you know, practice his hunting skills, chasing this little ball around. Sometimes just putting food up on elevated surfaces, like a few nuggets on top of the refrigerator in a dish and over on a windowsill, so he has to hunt for his dinner in your house. And try to substitute other things rather than food. So when he's sitting and meowing at you to eat, introduce a toy, like something on a string or a wand, so that instead of, you know, I'm going to just eat to entertain myself, now he's got some activity that's going to help him lose weight and, you know, give him something else to do besides looking for food.
There you go. Thank you very much, Christine, for calling. We have an email. Let's see, that email is from Sally. Please explain the progression of renal failure in dogs. My dog was diagnosed in February of this year. Initially, creatinine was 2.5. Not sure what the recent creat was, but it has worsened. He gets sub-Q fluids twice a week with a vet tech. Doing well with this. Originally, we were told he only had months, but he seems to be tolerating. It's been almost 6 months. He's almost 14, but wondering what we can expect.
Yeah, yeah. Cats and dogs vary differently with how they survive kidney disease. Dogs tend to not do as well as cats. Big things that you want to be looking at is making sure that your dog is on a kidney-friendly diet if they will eat it. There's several therapeutic diets that are out there that are lower in sodium, higher in potassium, and they're protein restricted. And that seems to make these dogs feel better and live longer if you can keep them on that. Be monitoring your dog's blood pressure. Blood pressure is one of those things that we sometimes forget about, but dogs with kidney disease often are hypertensive, and that can actually worsen their kidney disease. So their blood pressure needs to be really carefully watched and monitored. So hopefully your veterinarian's doing that. Also, make sure that your dog is kept well hydrated, especially in these hot summer days. You can really push them over the brink quickly by just having a day where they maybe don't have access to water or water's been limited. So lots and lots of water. And then checking for things like urinary tract infections and other infectious diseases, like things like there's a bacteria called leptospirosis that can affect the kidneys. And so, you know, have him evaluated for that. Hopefully that was done in February when it was initially diagnosed. But it's one of those things where eventually his appetite's probably going to decrease. Those values are going to start going up. He's going to start to feel pretty punky. I would recommend there is a website that you can go to that discusses kind of the progression of kidney disease and having your veterinarian help you with giving you copies of his lab data so that you can look at kind of this chart as to where he's at. It's called the IRIS. IRIS stands for International Renal Interest Society. So if you Google IRIS kidney, that website
it'll
should
pop
come up. Yeah. And very, very good. Talks about staging, treatment, you know, monitoring and so on, so that you can be well, just as well educated as your veterinarian.
Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more questions now. Let's go back to the phones. Jean in Hurley, you are next. Thank you for waiting, Jean. Hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have an older dog, and she's got calluses on her elbows.
Mm-hmm.
And recently she's been looking at them. I looked at one this morning. It looked a little bit raw, not really bleeding, but a little raw.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is she looking at them because they hurt? Is there something I can do to protecting her, or what can I do about it?
Yeah, what elbow calluses are you know, similar to like our elbows, where the tissue gets a little thickened, and but because dogs like to lay on rougher surfaces, and they often, as they age, may just plunk themselves down and bang those elbows, the skin over the elbow will start to lose the hair and gets this kind of thickened, kind of wrinkly skin. We can see infections too. So you want to make sure that, you know, if your dog is licking at them, that there isn't an underlying infection. And that would be something your veterinarian could very easily find out by just doing some impression smears, maybe doing a little skin scraping over the area and looking under the microscope and then treating appropriately. But for many dogs with calluses, the big thing is just making them more comfortable. There's a company that you can go, again, online. That's where I do all my shopping, so I know. But it's called Dog Legs, and it's, I think there's either two G's in the dog or two G's in the legs part, but Dog Legs. And they make a custom-made callus protectors. They're kind of elbow pads for dogs that are, you know, very soft inside, and so it adds some padding. You can put, you know, medication in there if you need to be able to treat them, and it helps protect them and allow them to heal. It's, you can imagine it's a tough spot to get to heal, because every time the dog lays down, it's going to be banging it again. But, you know, other things that you could do, padded surfaces, getting like egg crate foam with kind of a softer fleecy blanket on top of it, something nice and soft for your dog to lay on, that may help as well. But I really like these dog legs, and we use them a lot. A lot of owners buy them, and just, you know, they're a
really
wonderful
like
addition to all the stuff that's out there in the dog bed world, but something the dog just wears 24 hours a day.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. An email from Luann from La Crescent, Minnesota. My 9.5-year-old yellow lab is a healthy, active, non-overweight dog that eats adult dog food, which includes glucosamine and chondroitin. Is there any reason why she should be switched to a senior dog food?
Well, that is a very good question. We seem to be harping on pet food today, but again, when there was a survey that was done in the United States here, I think just surveying people to say, what do you think is different about senior dog foods? And almost everybody thought that they were going to be lower in protein, lower in calories, lower in sodium, lower in fat, and guess what? No regulations for senior food. Some of them are going to be higher. Okay, so if she's got a 9.5-year-old lab and she's perhaps on an adult light diet and switches to senior, the dog may gain weight, which is not going to help. So so some dogs don't benefit from senior foods. You know, and age is, in the dog world, is a relative thing. A 9.5-year-old miniature poodle is still young compared to a Labrador retriever. So unless there's a reason for switching to a specific diet, I wouldn't make the change. And recognize, too, that the glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate in pet food is usually way below therapeutic levels. So even though it says it's in there, it's usually not enough to be able to help your dog to maintain those healthy joints. So I would be talking to your veterinarian about supplements for the older dog. You know, again, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, there's a lot of different things like that out there. Perhaps extra antioxidants and so on too. But you know, if you want to switch to a senior food, make sure that you're still feeding your dog the same number of calories to prevent it from getting overweight.
And a caller wanted to tell you that he likes Milk-Bone dog biscuits.
Oh, okay.
He's happy to hear there's probably nothing in them that will hurt him.
Well, you know, and that's just it. They check so often now with pet foods that you'll see recalls being done because, you know, one batch they may have cultured something in. And a lot of times nothing's ever been reported in the dog food world. It's usually voluntary recalls. There was just some like chicken jerky strips that were from China that were having big issues with. A big shipment went to Canada and it was causing some kidney disease in dogs in Canada. You know, so probably stay with food that's manufactured in the United States. Kind of know, you know, follow the news, talk to your veterinarian. We're usually, you know, trying to keep up on all those things. But I have to admit, I don't think I would find dog like meat flavored chewy cookies that palatable. But yeah, go for it.
All right, Colette in River Falls, your turn. Hi, Colette.
Hi, I have a really wonderful golden retriever who's 5, and I used to brag he never had allergies. And, I mean, he's in great shape. All of a sudden, he started chewing his back foot raw, And he's also had a little ear issue. We've had been working with a vet with that with not a whole lot of help. But now he's chewing his back foot raw and his toe is turning bright red. And I'm not quite sure where to start.
Oh, that red color that you're seeing is either his skin being inflamed or it could be that the saliva that he's depositing on his foot in reaction to light will turn that kind of rusty brown color because there's a chemical called porphyrins in the saliva that will make that the foot turn that rusty brown. I would be looking for secondary infections. Many dogs that have allergies will end up getting yeast and bacterial infections kind of between their toes and between their pads, in their ears, and those specific areas need to be treated. And so that drives the itching. So they may have, you know, that low level of allergic skin disease where they're kind of itchy all the time, and then all of a sudden, boom, they're worse off. Be looking for those secondary infections.
Okay, he on his back foot is a it's on the top of his foot about an inch square where he's licked all the fur off.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, he could have a skin infection back there. You may be looking at putting an e-collar on him to keep him from chewing on his foot. Again, just putting an e-collar on and not actually treating the infection is not going to help him. So a phone call to your veterinarian, set up an appointment. Don't put this off because you can really get deep-seated infections and it can take a long time to get it under control. So get him in this afternoon if you can.
Good enough. Thank you very much for calling, Colette. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. To you now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Thanks. I have a question about my two indoor cats. Who are very precious, and they used to be outdoor cats, so I know how much they like to eat plants outside. And I'm wondering, you know, I buy them some of that wheatgrass now and then, and I bring in cat nip and cat mint from my garden, but I wonder if there's something, I just wonder if that's adequate. Like, is there something else that would be better for them in terms of plants?
No, that's fine. Some cats like finely chopped romaine lettuce that's kind of about the width of a grass blade as well. Just be careful with bringing in things from outdoors, especially if there's any pesticides used on the, you know, in your garden, which you probably would know if it's your own garden.
Right.
You know, cats do eat grass when they're outside, and some like a salad now and then, but it's not a necessary part of their diet if they're on a well-balanced diet. It's nice of you to do that. I don't do it for my cats, but you know, if that they like it,
oh,
by all means.
So excited.
Yeah.
Oh,
and you just have to watch your houseplants because if you have houseplants that could be potentially toxic, and probably the big one for cats are any of the lily plants, Asiatic lilies like Easter lilies and some of the decorative lilies. Keep those away. If you've got a cat that likes to eat plant material, they may go up and chew on that and it can put them into acute renal failure. So kidney disease. And they can die from it. So know what plants you've got in your house if you've got cats that like salads.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Talking about cats outdoors, we had friends, a company over a couple days ago anyway. And so the adults were sitting on the front porch and it was toward evening or even getting to evening. And the kids were inside. And a cat walked around the corner on the sidewalk, and there's a cat in our neighborhood that's an outdoor cat that looks a lot like Tiger. And I said, oh, there's that cat that looks like Tiger. And the cat came up and actually climbed up these front steps, and it was Tiger.
So somebody let him out.
Somebody left the door open in and out of the back door.
Yeah. And see, and that's the issue with cats is that they can sneak out. Sometimes you're carrying things. You don't even realize that they're out there. They, you know, sneak off. So many people lose their cats that way because they're not microchipped. They may not have ID on them. And I think even strictly indoor cats should be microchipped for those incidences where they may sneak out. So,
oh, it was a scary experience, I can tell you that, because I was really glad that he walked around to the front of the house instead of going out the backyard.
And I'm Larry's veterinarian, and so I'm thinking, okay, when do I have an open appointment to get them in to get them microchipped? But, you know, so feel free to.
We should really do that.
Yeah.
We'll do that, I promise. BG in Dedgeville, your turn. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having the show.
Sure.
I have a 10-year-old cat, and he's potentially got, I think I'm saying this right, a feline hyperaphagia.
Hyperesthesia, I bet
it
is. Now, let me try to guess, if you're just got the right name, okay, pronounced a little bit differently. He's twitching his skin on his back. doesn't like to be touched on his lower back, skin may ripple, and then he just like takes off like he's, you know, something's bit him. Sometimes they'll even hallucinate a little bit. They're acting like there's something flying above their head, and they may be looking up and batting at things. Is that what your cat's doing?
Oh, but the hallucination.
Okay. All right. Because sometimes...
That's coming.
That. Okay. And it's called feline hyper, which means overactive, aesthesia, which means sensitivity. We don't know why cats develop this. It's in the veterinary world, you will see this written up in dermatology books, and they'll talk about, you know, skin disease and things that are irritating their back, like, you know, flea issues or skin infections and that type of thing. You will also see it written up in neurology books, talking about things like spinal cord compression or nerve pinching that's causing some sensitivity over their lower back. And you'll also see it written up in the behavior world as well, where, you know, they're thinking that this may be a behavior problem where the cat is, you know, just does this type of, you know, the twitching and so on. All cats do it to some degree. If you watch any cat, they usually have, I call it their witching hour, where they're twitching their back and they're wiggling their butt and they race across the room. But these cats do it to excess, and they are, you know, just constantly twitching and looking at their back. I had a cat in a couple of years ago with this syndrome, and what had happened was about a month before, the cat had been bitten by one of the other cats in the household, and when we took an x-ray, there was actually some air under the skin, and we ended up treating. We had just a low level of cellulitis and infection there. We treated that. The infection went away, but the problem persisted, and the cat kept doing that. So we have to think there was probably some nerve irritation. This cat actually responded very well to a psychoactive drug, and the cat is on kind of a Prozac derivative, different than Prozac, but in that same class, and the cat's doing very, very well on that medication. So some of these cats respond to skin treatments, some of them respond to psychoactive drugs, and some of them, especially if they're doing this hallucinating type thing, respond to anticonvulsant drugs. It may be some type of a weird seizure disorder. So get them in for a physical, see if you can find anything medically wrong. And if not, be looking at it from the behavior standpoint.
Okay, yeah, we thought maybe behavior, because it sort of started after he decided that the younger cat that showed up was not his friend anymore. So,
okay.
And we tried some psychoactive drugs, and he kind of turned into a drooling idiot. So maybe we had too strong.
And it may have been an incorrect. Yeah, there's lots of different ones that you could try. And so don't give up and go back to your veterinarian and just say that, yeah, we've had issues with side effects or something else that we can use.
Yes, right. We'll try the psychoactive again. Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Email from Jason in Appleton. Wondering, or he says, please have your listeners check out dogfoodanalysis.com. And it's very easy to understand and follow the site and not affiliated with any dog food company. I think most folks will be amazed at just how low rated some of the brands are. Spend a couple of hours on this site and you will be highly educated.
Yeah, I mean, I have gone to that. And again, it is not a site that's managed by veterinary nutritionists. It's, things that are being evaluated by who knows. I don't know where, what credentials. So, again, you got to, you see online, you got to take it with a grain of salt.
On to Vivian in Green Bay. Hi, Viv.
Hello. A year ago, I rescued an abandoned cat. I would guess just a few weeks from death. But he has feline AIDS. And in the past year, he's remarkable. He looks beautiful. His health seems really good. The vet and I are guessing he might be 5 or 6 years old. He's a wonderful, wonderful cat. He is sequestered from my other cats. But I interact with him a half hour, 45 minutes to an hour every day. And I'm just wondering what your experiences are with feline AIDS.
Well, the actual name for this disease is FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus, FIV, kind of like HIV. And it is spread primarily through biting and interacting, with other cats outside that have the disease. It is not one of the diseases that's like in a friendly transfer. So if you have your cat in a room with your other cats, the infected cat with the other cats, and they get along and there's no fighting or anything like that, then your other cats probably would not pick up the disease. But I would not recommend that. I mean, it's just keep them separated by all means. There is a vaccine that you could potentially use for your healthy cats. It's not going to help the cat that's already infected, an FIV vaccine. I have never used it. But what we need to do when we do use it is counsel the client that their cats, once they're vaccinated, will always test positive. And so even your healthy cats, if they're vaccinated, would then test positive, and there could be some diagnostic confusion down the road. But that'd be, again, something that you can talk with your veterinarian about, whether it would be worthwhile to have your cats, healthy cats, vaccinated. But cats with FIV can live for years with it. Where they run into troubles is when they have secondary infections. So be on the lookout for things like dental disease. If you can brush his teeth, by all means do that. Routine dental care, making sure that he's on a good healthy diet, kept free of internal and external parasites. And they can live a long, long time with this. They usually die from other things, other than secondary infections, before they die of FIV.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Bill in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I have three cats, two of whom are about 7 years old, a brown tabby female and a very large Siberian male. Last year, about a year ago this week, took in a feral kitten that looked very malnourished. He kept coming around for days and days, so we took him in, and he's now healthy. He's so healthy. He's a buff tabby. He looks like a mountain lion.
Okay.
But the thing is, he's a very sweet cat with human beings. But he's got the other two cats terrorized, especially the female.
Yeah.
And he doesn't hurt them. In other words, he'll jump on Charlie, the Siberian, and he'll chew on his neck. It's almost like a sexual thing. He doesn't ever break the skin, he'll get in set twos with the female. The female's howling and growling and he's hitting him with his paws, but his claws are never out.
Yeah,
he never draws. But for some reason, he's got the other two just terrorized.
And that is such a common problem. You have a nice, quiet, stable, two-cat household, and then you bring in the little devil. And a couple of things it potentially could just be that he's play aggressive, that that's his way of playing, and that your cats don't like to play that way. And so making sure that you are interacting with the new cat, playing appropriately with toys on strings and wands, that you're there supervising all the interactions so that if he looks like he's going to start going after the other cat, you can be right there to redirect him to an appropriate thing so that especially your female cat isn't being terrorized by him. It's also possible that he's just a bully, and there are cats that are bullies that like to be in control of the space, and they will pounce on the other cats and chase them. And if you've got a cat that's not afraid to stand their ground, they may have a truce. But if you've got another cat like your female that may be a little more, inhibited and so on, she may just lay there and scream and so on. And he's just ignoring very clear signals from her to stop. So you need to be there to make sure that that isn't happening. I would. Yep.
Yes. Is there I was looking online, and it seems like there are canine behaviorists or a dime a dozen, but I haven't been able to find a feline behaviorist in this area.
Yeah, in the Madison area, there's several people. I mean, even you can talk to your veterinarian. Many veterinarians are well-versed in behavior. Here in Madison, we're very lucky to have Dr. Rodan at the Cat Care Clinic, who has done extensive behavior work. We have Dog's Best Friend, which also also does cats, and there are they are applied animal behaviorists in the Black Earth area, but would be, you know, that would be another location that you could look into. And then we have another veterinarian named Dr. Sue Krebsbach that does house calls, and she's a veterinarian with a strong interest in behavior, and works with the Feral Cat Friends of Ferals group, and does house calls and so on. And I think her business is called Creature Comfort. So there's a few for you to be looking into, and that would be a really good idea, so they can see the interaction between the cats. But in the meantime, to give your female cat some peace, I would keep them separate. Be looking at adding in more cat trees, shelves, and so on, where instead of expanding your space by putting an addition on your house, you're expanding vertically, so that she's got some areas that she can retreat to that are safe for her. And all interactions need to be supervised by you. You may even find that you have to have the new cat on a harness and leash, so he can't run and chase after the other kitties when they're together in the room, so you have some control over them.
But, there you go.
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Back to the question about microchipping. We were talking about microchipping our kitties. If your pet has a chip but you have stopped paying the yearly fee to the registry, is it still a way to track them, or is there still a way?
There's a couple of things that you can do. There's a free online registration service that's called 24-Hour Pet Watch, and I would go onto their website. I think up in the right-hand corner there's a little button that says register here. They also sell pet insurance, and so they're getting you on their site, and they're doing this, and it's it's a free service. So look into that. I'd contact the company and just see, do they just dump your data when you haven't paid? That's a good question. But it can start to add up over the years, especially if you're dealing with a chip that, they charge you an annual fee to keep the database updated. And if, the chip means nothing unless it's hooked into a database. So check out the 24-Hour Pet Watch. I think that might be a good one to go to if it's becoming cost prohibitive to keep it your pet registered through the company.
Dave in Bluegrass, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Great show.
Thank you.
I'm actually sitting along the road here near Patch Grove, Wisconsin. We have two Siberian Huskies, and we feed them a grain-free kibble. But a lot of people that have Siberian Huskies think it's best to feed their dogs a raw diet.
Mm-hmm.
And information that I find on the internet, which, a grain of salt again, is conflicting.
Yeah.
And I've talked to our veterinarian, and he said that there's some, you really have to do your research, you really got to know what you're doing, and then there are problems. You have to worry about salmonella, and so I guess I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the subject.
Yeah, I think it is something that you have to go into it being very educated. Anytime that you're dealing with raw meat, the same thing that can affect us. If you're working with raw chicken or raw beef, you can run into problems with your dog, although they tend to be a little more resistant to actually, developing symptoms of the infection. The fact that the humans are dealing with this, dealing with the dishes. There was a study done that they looked at dishes that had raw meat in them and then put through the dishwasher, different washing methods, and they were still able to culture salmonella even after it had gone through the standard dishwashing cycle. So keep all the utensils separate, especially if you've got anyone in the family that is immunocompromised, which would include young children, elderly people, people on chemotherapy or anything like that. Have to be very, very careful with dealing with the pet, handling their waste, because that they are at risk of becoming infected as well. And same holds true for things like body part toys, like pig ears and stuff. They're always in the news with finding E. coli and salmonella and things like that. So avoid having those in your house if you've got someone who is immunocompromised. The other issue with raw diets is you're making it yourself. And the big problem is recipe shift. You may have really good intentions of having a well-balanced diet. You're using the right supplements. You're doing everything right. And then you run out of something and you just start fudging it on your own. I had a client in just a few months ago that was started out well, but then she read somewhere online that blueberries are a good source of antioxidants. And she started substituting blueberries for something else. And it turned into this most bizarre diet. The dog started losing weight and having issues. And it's stick with a diet, a regular recipe. Also look at where these recipes come from. I usually, if people want to feed a raw diet, I will direct them to a veterinary nutritionist. There's several that have online sites. There's one that I'd recommend called balanceit.com, and that would be one that you could go to that have veterinary nutritionists. These are boarded veterinarians, well-versed in nutrition, that can help you with coming up with an appropriate diet for your dog, and provide you with all the appropriate supplements, which is how they make their money as well. So that might be something to look into. But is it necessary? By all means, no. Do I feed my dogs a raw diet? No. I think that a well-balanced commercial diet is going to keep my dogs healthier in the long run than me trying to cook for them and knowing that, you know, I don't run to the grocery store. I'm out of milk the one day. I mean, hey, that's supposed to be part of my diet, and I don't have it, you know, in my fridge every day. So, you know, am I going to be the same way with my pets? Probably.
Probably.
So, yeah.
So, there you go.
Yeah.
I think the risks are just not worth it myself.
There you go. And it's definitely, you know, it's out there. And it really started, all the grain-free and raw diets, after about 2 or 3 years ago, there was that melamine scare from China, where there was some food that was contaminated. Ever since then, this has been the trend. But sticking with a U.S. company, you know, that is, you know, well-balanced, AFCO-tested foods. It stands for American Association of Feed Control Officials. Sometimes you get what you pay for, except when, you know, it may say premium, and premium may not mean anything. So, yeah.
Well, there thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Your time.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Connie in Portage, let's go to you next. Hi, Connie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a problem with, I don't really have a problem. I have a new corgi puppy. Well, he's 9 months old. And I'm wondering how long before he will settle down. I'm used to English bulldogs.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. you've gone from the couch potato to a very active, you know, little, like, I think they were used for herding and things too. So, maybe never. What I think you need to be doing is channeling that activity into more appropriate ways. So be looking at dog training classes, dog agility, if you are not in a position to be walking your dog or taking your dog to dog parks, if it's a dog friendly dog and you trust the park, then by, you know, hiring someone else to do that. Doggy daycare is a great way to have your dog burn off steam. Going there even a couple of days a week, this can be enough for some dogs. Sometimes they need it daily. But expecting your dog to outgrow bad behaviors or inappropriate behaviors, I think you'd probably be waiting a long time. So, work on trying to fix it with doing those things that I just mentioned.
Thanks for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking your pet's health. And a Facebook question from Julie, who says, my 18-month-old miniature poodle seems to be more quiet and sleeping more than normal. We live in vacation in an area with ticks and tick diseases. He's already been treated one time for Lyme. Could this change in behavior be a symptom of tick disease or just a dog growing out of the puppy stage?
Oh, you know, an 18-month-old miniature poodle should still be really active unless he's like gotten fat or, you know, something like that, where he's going to be slowing down because he's, you know, just can't move as fast, which I hope that's not the case. Change in behavior like this is enough to say, for me to say, bring your pet in for me to see it. If they've had been exposed to Lyme in the past, there's a very good possibility that he's been exposed again. He may have other tick-borne diseases. There's a whole host of things to be looking at. And I think a good physical exam, some lab work, if you've been picking ticks off your dog, obviously talk about tick control with your veterinarian, and then, getting some tests done for these tick disease screens if you're concerned about that. But yeah, that's not normal for a year and a half old dog. Yeah.
All right. Well, we have another Facebook question from Katie in Dalton. I have a 1-year-old lab who jumped out of the car window a week ago Sunday when I was stopped and he saw some dogs standing in their yard. He skinned his right front leg and his nose. And it all seems to be healing. Is there anything else I should be concerned with?
Probably not. I mean, it's not that high of a jump. Thank goodness the car was stopped. I have had dogs jump out while it's been moving and have not fared quite as well as Katie's dog. Just watch those wounds and make sure he's not licking at them. Remember, that's an old wives' tale. Dogs licking their wounds make them heal faster. Actually slows down healing and can get them infected and so on and macerated. So don't let them do that. Probably if he's not limping, he's not having any other issues, I wouldn't be too concerned. But get a seatbelt for your dog. They make these harnesses. You can seatbelt your dog in. If this is going to be a recurrent theme for your dog, it you may not be as lucky the next time. So either a crate or a seatbelt harness that is fitted appropriately for your dog.
Mary in Platteville, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting, Mary. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. We adopted a Chesapeake Bay or possibly a Lab. We're not quite sure. He appears to be middle age. And we've had him since November. A large number of amount of urine output has taken us to the vet several times. He will have urine for 30 to 60 seconds, a full stream several times a day. Ultimately, that led to finding a tumor on his thyroid. There was a needle biopsy. He's deemed to be a truly hyperthyroid dog with a benign tumor.
Wow. That's rare.
That's my understanding. Our veterinarian is quite puzzled.
Mm-hmm.
We recently took him in for a bladder infection, very tender in the bladder area, passing blood. Now, the interesting thing was his urinalysis came back looking relatively normal.
Okay.
He did have a very high bilirubin count. We did a chem panel, and that came back normal. I know that there's very little on a dog like this, but do you have any ideas what we can expect for quality of life for him?
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I would be looking at. We see hyperthyroid cats day in and day out. I mean, it's very common for cats to get benign nodules. I just had a dog in last week when most dogs that have a thyroid mass, they're usually a thyroid carcinoma. And, you know, you're looking at either like radiation therapy, surgery, if it's possible, depending on whether it's adherent or not. In this case, if they've identified that your dog has a benign thyroid mass, surgical removal would be something to think about. You may want to talk to like either one of the specialists at the veterinary school in the internal medicine department regarding radioactive iodine. We do that very commonly for cats, but because this is not something that we see I've never seen it in a dog. The only time I've seen a hyperthyroid dog is either with a malignant tumor or if they've been overdosed on their thyroid medication when they're being treated for hypothyroidism. But radioactive iodine is commonly used for cats. There's also kind of anti-thyroid drugs. There's a class of drug called methimazole that we use very commonly in cats. It's a human medication, and I'm sure there's something out there for treating dogs as well. The problem we have when an animal is maintained in a hyperthyroid state is their metabolism is just in overdrive, and eventually they'll end up with heart disease. They can become hypertensive. It can affect their kidneys. It can, you can see liver changes. There's a whole host of things that can happen, and they just become very thin and cachectic. The last case I saw, which is so unfortunate, right before I came here, was a kitty that was diagnosed 2 years ago as being hyperthyroid, and the owner elected to not treat it because she couldn't get the pills in and not realizing that there was other ways of administering the medication, and just left the cat, and now the cat is no longer with us. It came in very, very severely debilitated. And, so that was a kind of a sad way to end my morning before coming in here. So it can be a fatal disease. It may take longer than, some diseases, but eventually your dog is going to die. So look into treatment. I really think that, surgery probably would be the way to go.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling. And Judy and Monona, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. We adopted a little Cocker Spaniel about a year and a half ago. And this summer, she has discovered fresh raspberries off the cane.
Oh, a little dog after my own heart. Yeah.
Well, yes, after mine, too.
Yeah.
But I know I'm not supposed to feed them grapes and raisins, but is there anything wrong with raspberries?
No, no, there isn't. It's just the fact that you're missing out on one of the the benefits of summer in Wisconsin is fresh raspberries. Oh, okay. So a time for a little fence around your raspberry bushes or something so that you can keep your dog out of there.
I was debating whether to fence the dog or the raspberry.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. All
one
right.
Or the other.
Yeah. One or the other, but nothing. No, it would not hurt the dog to eat those. But thank you for bringing up the grapes. Yep. I've got a bumper crop of grapes this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank goodness my dogs are, they couldn't care less about my grapevines, but there are probably dogs out there that would like to eat those. And we can run into problems with dogs going into kidney failure from eating grapes. So be careful.
Is there a list anywhere of things that you shouldn't, things that, that your dog should be not eating?
Well, I mean, you could. I mean, I've just, in the past, I just Googled, you know, toxic foods for dogs, and there's always lists and things that come up. But raisins and grapes, macadamia nuts is another one that can be a problem. Chocolate and anything that contains, you know, the theobromine or caffeine. Dogs are very sensitive to it. I'm trying to think, is there anything else that we have to worry about? Those would probably be the top ones that I can think of. And as you know, if something else comes to mind before, you know, when we get back from break, I will announce it.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Thanks for calling. What about kitties?
Kitties, they tend to be a little more discriminating with their eating habits. So so we don't tend to run into as many troubles. It's more like the plant material, like the lilies that I talked about, that could be an issue for them.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Really appreciate it. Dr. Sandy, we have one of the things I wanted to talk about was generic pet medications.
Mm-hmm.
Are they as good as the name brand versions?
Oh, you know, I'm going to say it depends.
Yeah.
What has just recently happened is I've had a lot of people asking me about a product that they've been seeing in some of the stores. Most people are familiar with Frontline, which is a product that contains fipronil that the Mariel company makes. Excellent product for flea and tick control. In fact, I don't know if I'm going to be spilling the beans here sooner, but they're coming out with a slightly tweaked Frontline called Certifact that's going to be even more effective than Frontline is.
Mm.
So, they're announcing that, and it's going to be on the market sometime towards the end of the month. I think there's a big meeting that they're announcing it at. That's something to be watching for. But when I was in Sam's the other day, the Sam's warehouse, I walked past this display and I went, look, just like Frontline. And it was a product called Pet Armor. And I'm reading the ingredients and it's all the same. The question is, even though it's got fipronil in it, is it the same carrier? Does it spread through the hair coat like other spot-ons? Who knows? But we don't have to worry about that any longer because it turned out that the company that's making it, as well as several others, broke a patent law and all their product has been seized and they have 60 days to get it off the shelf. So if you want it, better go out and buy it now. But, you know, when it comes to like things like heartworm preventatives, there are, you know, many other products out there. We carry a couple of the major manufacturers at the veterinary school, but we can't, I mean, stock everything. And there are some owners that are very cost sensitive, and there are some kind of generic heartworm preventatives so that contain like the same chemical as HeartGuard, but in a non-chewable pill. But just make sure that you're working with a reputable online pharmacy if you're going that route. It should have a little symbol at the bottom that's a little gold oval that says Vet VIPS, V-I-P-P-S. It stands for veterinary inspected pharmacy, and I can't remember what the other P stands for, but it means you are getting good drug that's not outdated, that's what you need and what you want. So talk to your vet before you start switching, though.
Kristen in Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I'm so excited that you're on the radio today.
Yeah.
I recently adopted two Persians from a rescue. One has a little flatter face than the other. And his eyes are constantly weeping, and I guess this is normal for the breed. This is our first time working with this breed. But I'm wondering if there's any supplement I can give him that would kind of help with those tears, because he gets really uncomfortable with all the crunchies, and I wipe his face every day, but it still bothers him.
Yeah. I mean, if he's got an eye infection, either bacterial or if he, you know, has been diagnosed with feline herpes, which is rhinotracheitis is the other name for it. Sometimes adding in a taurine supplement can help with virus replication if he does have something like that going on. But in general, Persian cats, just like my bulldogs, probably the best article I ever saw on this was written in the Journal of Small Animal Practice, and you might be able to find it if you do like a literature search or something online, where they showed skulls of Persian cats, like normal cats and Persian cats, and they put in a latex into the tear ducts after the time of death. And then when they looked at the skulls and then where the tear ducts were, these like very, you know, highlighted like red lines where the tear ducts were, these flat-faced Persians, actually their tear duct makes a more than right angle bend. It actually has to go up and around the nose and they get kinked. And so we've got, you know, the problem where when they start making these, you know, tears, they can't flow out of the eye and down into the nose like normal tears. And so they flow out onto the face. So checking for patency of the tear ducts would be something that could be done under, they'd have to probably be a little sedated to be able to do that. But that would be something that either your veterinarian or an ophthalmologist could do to see if that's, you know, something flushing the tear ducts would help. But it comes down to, just like with my bulldogs, constantly cleaning the face on a daily basis. It's once a day. You just do it like clockwork and keep it from getting to that point where it's crusty.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Bob and Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter lives in St. Paul, and she and her husband have got two cats. They recently went on a three-week vacation and left the cats. The cats stayed in the house in the care of a house sitter, and the house sitter did a pretty fair job of cleaning out the one cat box, but apparently he wasn't sifting out the urine balls. And so after a while, the cats just simply stopped using the litter box, at least for their urine.
Mm-hmm.
And they were spotting all over the house. And,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hopefully someone has talked to your daughter regarding making sure that the litter box management is just at the very best for the cats. And what I would consider good litter box management for a two-cat household would be three boxes in the house, regardless of the size of your home, okay? Sorry, but then you have to start thinking, do I want to get more cats if you're living in an efficiency apartment? Three litter boxes in three separate locations so that they're not all side by side. I use the analogy of building your dream home and putting all the toilets in one bathroom. Doesn't do the family any good. So have them separated out, uncovered. Soft, scoopable, sandy litter is usually what's preferred. And the latest research on cat litter has shown that the wheat-based litters appear to not be accepted by very many cats. And so if she's using something like that, maybe switching to a different, more acceptable litter. And then looking at a litter with the carbon activated charcoal additive rather than baking soda, that appears to be one that cats like a little bit better as well. And as you've said, keeping them clean, at least initially twice a day, scooping of urine and stool, and so that they're just kept clean. Again, you know, how often do we flush our toilet, you know? And if it wasn't, what would you think? You know, it would be like, ah, I don't want to use this anymore. The spots where the cats have gone, I've hopefully been cleaned effectively. I like to use, there's a couple of products that I really like. My favorite one is called Urine Off. You can order it online. Some of our local veterinarians sell it in their practices. And you can even get it through some like carpet cleaner supply companies and so on. And then the other one is called Anti-Icky Poo, AIP. And they are both very good enzymatic products. Most of the time when owners are cleaning up after cats have had an accident, they're just cleaning the surface of the carpet with maybe like a foam rug cleaner. And this urine is down in the carpet pad and sometimes the subfloor. So you really need to get it, you know, down and soaked and treated with the cleaner.
Hmm.
Could you clarify one thing? You said a wheat-based...
There's one called Sweet Scoop, and there's several others out there. Latest research that was at a meeting last fall said that one, when they've done kind of a litter box trial, a little smorgasbord of litter boxes, and say, you know, which one do you like the best? That one was often avoided by cats. So the, you know, soft, scoopable, sandy litter with an activated charcoal odor control agent in it would be the one to be looking for if you had to find the litter that the majority of cats like. But you also have to look at what does the cat like and mm-hmm. And stay with that.
And you've talked about litter box size in the past.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You know, some people will get these like little itty bitty tiny litter boxes when they have a kitten, and then they don't adjust them to the size of the cat as it gets to be an adult, kind of like going from a potty chair to a toilet as you grow up, okay? And so if we were forced to continue to use a little kid's potty chair, it would be a problem for us. So litter box needs to be 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So measure your cat. You're not going to find very many litter boxes that are commercially available that are that big for some of the big cats that I see. So I'll tell people to use like cement mixing trays that you can get at a home improvement store. They're inexpensive, $2 or $3. You've got a good, sturdy, heavy plastic tray. Sometimes we'll... you know, use like the storage bins. Be careful if the cats are older and they can't jump. You need to use something like a, you know, take a storage bin and actually cut out an opening so that they can just, you know, walk in easily so they're not having to jump up and over. That's what I use at my house. I love the storage bins. They really work well. So.
All right. There you go.
Like perhaps like a sweater box or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, yeah. That kind of thing works really well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Carolyn in Manawa, how do you know? Hi.
Hello. I can't believe it. You answered two of my questions while I was waiting. I also have two Persian cats, but the problem is the mother cat, it was my husband's cat, and he passed away almost 2 years ago. The same month that he passed away, he had her bred, and so she had kittens, and she loved this one kitten, and I figured, well, my husband is gone, I'll keep one of the kittens. Now, the kitten is almost 2 years old, and the mother hates her, and the kitten has a habit of going by her, and every time she does it, the mother kitten actually jumps on her and tries to bite her.
Yeah, well, this is no, you're no longer dealing with a mother cat and kitten. You're dealing with two adult cats now. And
right.
It's very different than like a human relationship where we recognize, you know, our parents as our superiors, you know, for a long time. It's, you know, I think we've had a call similar to this on the, you know, earlier this morning where we've got cats that are just not social with each other. Things to consider, expand their territory, lots of cat trees, elevated shelves so that they are not forced to be in each other's space. Be
right.
there to interact and not let them have contact with each other unless you are there to supervise the contact so that there, you know, there is no fighting, because cats will not fight it out and go, okay, you won. It usually will escalate into the cat that's the victim, you know, just getting all defensive if they just even see the bully cat. And so
they're not gonna get better.
Yeah, they won't get better. So you know,
okay.
keeping them separate. Yeah. And not all cats get along. I mean, and so, you know, either looking at living in a house divided or expanding their territory, you could try plugging in some feel away, which is the pheromone that cats deposit with their cheeks onto vertical objects. So it comes in a little atomizer. You can plug it in. Sometimes that has a natural calming effect for cats. So that might be something to consider. But yeah, time to retire the word kitten and say you're dealing with two adults.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't hear that earlier.
Oh, that's
okay.
Sorry for your loss.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Sean in Fond du Lac, we turn to you. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thanks, Larry and Sandy. Good to hear from you.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I got a dog. It's a Husky Samoyed mix. She's now 13 and a half. and she's definitely acting her age a lot more than she did when she was a puppy, you know, say 5-6 years ago. But she had parvo as a puppy, and I'm just wondering if there's any link there between her longevity and the treatment she got as a pup.
Probably not. You're lucky that she survived. A lot of puppies don't survive parvovirus. But the fact that she was infected as a youngster, she probably has lifetime immunity, that particular disease. Probably the only issues that we can see is sometimes, and most of these dogs die very, very early, is parvovirus likes rapidly growing cells, and so it hits the cells that are turning over in the intestinal tract, which is why they get diarrhea. It also affects the bone marrow, and which is why their blood cell counts drop and they become septic because they don't have cells to fight off infection. It can also, in some cases, affect the heart muscle, and they'll often die of acute heart failure or heart disease. So, but the fact that she survived that. It just, you know, a good indication that either she's got good genes or, you know, good veterinary preventive medicine care, and she's been on a, you know, good nutrition, good exercise. You're doing everything right to have a large breed dog like that live that long. And I hope she has many more years.
Great to hear. If I got time for one more quick question on the same dog. Now that she's older. And it never used to bother, but thunderstorms, fireworks, things like that, she goes into a shaking rage.
Yeah, and for many dogs, as they get older, if they start losing their hearing, the noise phobias go away. But in your case, my guess is that she probably was a little anxious in the past, but it's escalated as she's gotten older. It may be that, it was mild before and now it's just gotten worse, or something happened. Maybe she was out in the backyard when there was a loud bang or something that scared her, and that's now, affected her at this point in her life. Things to be talking to your veterinarian about, besides doing the normal things you would do, like giving her a little bomb shelter if she's comfortable hiding in a closet or going down in the basement, by all means, do something like that. Having some white noise going, plugging in a DAP diffuser, which is a different pheromone than the cat one, but some dogs, it can hurt them, so you can give that a try. They make this thing called an anxiety wrap that is a vest that the dog can wear that kind of swaddles them, and for some dogs, that's enough to make them feel more relaxed and comfortable, kind of like swaddling a baby. So check that out online. And then we look at medical management. The drug to avoid would be a drug called Aceprom, still prescribed by many veterinarians, but it actually makes them more sensitive to noises, and it's older dogs can be profoundly affected by it. It's a sedative, and I just find it's not effective for noise phobias. But trying a little tinge of a Valium type drug, usually I'll use a drug called Xanax or Alprazolam, a generic form, and just a little bit of that sometimes takes the edge off the dog. But you do need to medicate before the storm or fireworks or anything happens. So you got to be a weather watcher and be, getting that medication into her early and often.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's kind of what I was wondering if, like, say, doggy Paxil or Xanax or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Was going to do her more harm than good at this point in her life?
Well, I think it's a very safe drug. Your veterinarian may want to do a little bit of lab work beforehand, since it's not a licensed drug for dogs. We do use it. There are very few licensed psychoactive drugs that we can use that are in that profile for dogs. So, making sure that she's healthy and happy before you give it isn't a bad idea.
And thanks very much for calling. An email from Susan in Delafield. Sometimes my dog will vomit after drinking water. It's clear, colorless. Usually not a large amount, usually has an undigested dog kibble or two in it. It can happen after an exercise session or not. And I just lost the, what did I do with it? Oh, there it is.
There it is. Okay.
I was looking.
Okay.
We had him since last October, but this has just started in the last couple of months.
Yeah.
Cause for concern?
Yeah, probably not. My guess is that he's probably just drinking a ton of water at a time. He's probably coming in from being outside. It's hot weather. He tanks up on water, stretches his stomach, and up it comes. So if he's keeping his food down, he's not vomiting at any other time. He's happy and playful, and it's just happening when, he overdoes it at the water bowl. Things that you may want to do is ration the water. Obviously, don't water deprive him, but put, a smaller amount in the bowl so he can take that. get that going through a system, and maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes later, give him a little bit more. It's more the mess. I mean, my dogs do the same thing, and I have to just be really careful that, you know, if it's because it's pretty slippery on the floor, and, you know, and you've got to make sure that they just get a little bit at a time, and that seems to keep it under control.
Nikki has a 12-year-old, almost 12-year-old dachshund who was diagnosed in January with sac adenocarcinoma?
Anal sac adenocarcinoma.
Anal sac, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
X-ray taken in March indicated the tumor had spread, was taking up much of the room in his abdomen, pushing his internal organs up and out. He was given 1 to 2 months. It's now July, so it's been many months more. He's still alive, although we have recently seen a decline in his health. What do we need to look for to let us know he's in pain?
Oh, you know, this is a nasty kind of cancer, and that's why every time you take your pet into the vet clinic, even though the dog doesn't like having a rectal done, getting a rectal done. And these do metastasize. If it's already spread, I mean, obviously chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, that kind of thing is out of the question right now. Hopefully the dog is on some pain medication to be able to control any discomfort. There's one that that we typically use called Piroxicam is what usually, it's a human drug, but our oncologists like to use that because it does have some kind of anti-cancer effects as well. So check with your veterinarian about using that. Boy, you know your dog best if their appetite's off, they're not socially interactive, they're, hiding more, they're not typically going to cry out in pain or act that uncomfortable. But, if your dog's having trouble defecating because of the size of the mass, those would be all things that would be kind of deciding factors as to when to say it's time to say goodbye. And I'm just so happy for you that you've had 6 months with your dog. That's amazing. That really is for that type of cancer.
Sandy in Waukesha, it's your turn now. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a white bull terrier that's covered with mosquito bite welts.
Okay.
And I can't keep him from going out and laying in the grass. And right now, the mosquitoes are so bad, and I'm not quite sure what to do about treating them, or is there any kind of repellent that's safe to use on a dog so he doesn't get...
What are you using for your flea and tick control?
Nothing.
Well, there's your question. There's your answer. Talk to your veterinarian or go to the pet store and get a product with permethrin in it. It's the one that I carry in my practice is called Advantix. It's put on once a month. It does repel mosquitoes. You have to be careful with using the right size, so make sure you've got an accurate weight on your dog, that you use it appropriately. There are instructions in the package as to how to apply it. It's applied once a month and is very effective at helping these guys. So that would be what I would be recommending. Do not use any of the DEET human products and so on. I get concerned about using those things on pets. They're not licensed for pets. They lick themselves. We put it on. Even for us, they tell you to apply it to clothing and things. And if you do put it on your skin, we don't put our fingers in our mouth or whatever, and we wash it off. So I have had people use a little bit of the Skintastic stuff that's safe for babies. But again, that's off-label use. It's not approved for use in dogs. But sometimes in really heavy mosquito areas, a little spritz of that on those sensitive spots may make the dog feel a little more more comfortable.
All right. There we go. All right. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. And Marty wonders, is it safe to use Gold Bond powder on the underarm of my dog who got a sore spot there and won't stop licking it?
Wow, why is there a sore spot there? If you've got skin-on-skin contact, I worry about yeast infections. I used to have a basset hound, and they would always get kind of grody armpits, and we'd find yeast all the time. And so it's bothering the dog. It's itching the dog. If you put powder on, it's probably just going to lick the powder off. So find out why the dog is licking to begin with, and get it treated appropriately that way before you start just using over-the-counter products for people.
Always a pleasure, Sandy. And you'll be back
Second Tuesday of July.
Of August.
Or of August. Yes, yes. Well, this is July. Where's the month gone?
Oh, yeah, man. Well, we'll look forward to it. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right. August 9th. There you go.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She will be back on August 9th. Tomorrow we'll talk with Candace Andrews about her new book, Beyond the Trees, Story of Wisconsin Forests, and then discuss bats with DNR bat ecologist Dave Riddell. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.